Yeah. So I started the recording and then we can ease into our weekly dish of pornography, philosophy, mysticism, spirituality.
I noticed you put pornography first there. It was the first in your list of priority. Like, I guess that's the bottom layer, right?
Of course.
That's the world is just a big orgy, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, but you know the saying, no, you can't trust a man who can't handle a beer. Also, yeah. You can't handle a man who can handle his penis. You know?
You can't handle a man who can't handle
his penis. No, you can't trust a man
who can't handle his penis.
Yes.
Oh yeah, I agree with that.
You know?
For sure. Yeah.
Who's a wimp in you know, the sexual arena?
So what do you think of Johnny Depp? Do you think he can handle his penis?
Well, I'm really torn in this one, you know?
You're torn. That's because you're in love with Amber. I'm pretty sure.
No, I told you like a couple of weeks ago that I'm Team Amber. I don't know. I mean, obviously she lied, but I'm not so set in my opinion that, you know, that the whole thing was a one-sided thing.
Everybody lies.
But then again, yeah. I did not follow the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I was listening to Johnny Depp at a press conference, and he's doing Marlon Brando again. I kind of like that. I like the way he talks very slowly. He says very abstract things.
Yeah.
He doesn't say obvious things, which is kind of interesting. I mean, I like his mind. And I like his presentation of himself as kind of a, you know, a pirate. I like pirates.
You like pirates?
Sure, I like pirates, yeah.
So you know what? There's like this, males and females have different archetypes, right? Do you know that theory?
Yes, yes, I know that. I know what you're going to say, yeah. Yeah, women like billionaires, pirates, and... you know what else?
Surgeons and werewolves and vampires.
Werewolves and vampires, of course. What women like monstrous beings?
Yeah. Speaking of that, you know, we had like a topic before that is of the well-rounded personality. And if a philosopher has to embody what he's preaching.
Yes. And we hosted Cadell, and he was talking about Nietzsche. And there were some discussions about Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And some arguments about Nietzsche. It's like, okay, was Nietzsche... I mean, Nietzsche doesn't have to be consistent, does he? He was he lived his philosophy in the sense he, you know, he knew he was a dangerous person. He knew that he was using gunpowder. So trying to fit him, trying to make him sane or anything might be a bit of a bad strategy. On the other hand, he's full of contradictions.
Like every one of us, yes.
He's full of intense contradictions, though. It's like, for example, he's very anti-Christian, and then at the end of his life, he was proclaiming, you know, I am the crucified one. You know, he was, you know, he's all about health and vitality and you know, about the overman, where he was sickly and couldn't even drink tea most of his life. So there's all of these contradictions in his character, right?
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a critique about it. Maybe that's why he was who he was. I mean, we always long or try to express the opposite of ourselves in a way. We're attracted to the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah, I just saw the recent trailer for the David Bowie documentary, Munich Daydream, which looks amazing. Mm. And so there are some interesting aspects of his biography, you know, so that he said that he doesn't feel anything, that he's somewhat dead and feels like a robot, except he's on stage.
Oh, right.
And so his ex-wife said he was a cold motherfucker. And so if you, and those kind of things, and if you put all this together, there's a certain, let's say, psychological disposition, or let's say a mental health issue that kind of fits to David Bowie,
Yeah, well, when you're on the stage, you are expressing otherness, right? You're expressing the opposite of who you are. I also heard Nick Cave say that he's an atheist, right? He's not a believer. He's kind of a rationalist atheist in terms of his mind, what he thinks is true intellectually. But when he's on stage, he believes in God. He's a total believer. So that's very interesting. I thought that was a very interesting commentary.
Yeah, but I mean, it's so interesting because we have two conflicting ideals. You know, you have the one ideal of the artist as one who channels the unknown, you know, and brings into being that which has not emerged yet. Yes. And so for these kinds of people, there's in lots of cases a disconnect between the performance and the art and their personal character, as exemplified by Nietzsche or David Bowie or whatever. And then this is like the one ideal, because what you're saying, you need the inner conflict or whatever it is to create something new, right? And then you have on the other side, the more, let's say, psychological or spiritual ideal of the well-rounded personality, where the goal is to have a contradiction-free approach to the world. So
maybe that's an unrealistic goal, though.
No, I mean, both maybe are unrealistic. But they're ideals, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea that there is from what you think, what you say, what you do, that there is no internal contradiction there, because that's basically the ideal of the spiritual and psychological worldview, but that kind of doesn't jive very well with the artistic approach, you know, because if you're like internally really well balanced, you know, you don't have like the sport, like as David Bowie has, to deflower 16-year-old girls, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I'm not sure if I agree. I think even spiritual mastery might appear to have its contradictions. Like the master, like, you know, like I think of somebody like Chogyam Trungpa, who was a fat guy who drank, you know, and he said, like, you know, I'm not even intelligent enough to be a busboy. You know, but he brought an entire lineage of Buddhism to the West, did all these incredible things at the same time. So even I think even the spiritual master is full of seemingly contradictions. Maybe even more. Maybe he's even more of that, more surprising in terms of, you know, maybe integrity is something that we don't really understand. Because it doesn't mean becoming this. Well, I don't think it means becoming a. In one way, I think becoming a well-rounded person is maybe a lower stage. You know, you become a well-rounded person is the goal of maybe sutric practice, to be develop wisdom and compassion and be strong and be able to, you know. And then when you get into another stage, when you get into the tantric stage, it's not about being a well-rounded person. You might be able to be a well-rounded person, but it's about magic. It's about transformation. It is about art. It is about, you know, the highest form of art, I would say, which is not necessarily, not personal, which is not about a well-rounded personality, because it's not about a personality. It's David Bowie on stage is many different personalities. He's never one thing. Because the one thing doesn't exist. There is no central, there is no core to that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we have to differentiate a bit, because of course your arguments are kind of true. Also in terms of Buddhism is the most contradictory of all religion, because, you know, you have a 300 kilo fat slob who teaches about self-discipline, right? And that's a contradiction in itself, you know.
And well, unless he is actually disciplined, you know.
No, well, in order to have 300, to have a 300-pound bloated body, you know, you have to eat like kind of without discipline, you know.
Well, there's all different types of, you know, if you study the cities, the masters, there's some that never get out of bed.
I just find it pretty.
And there's
rich.
There's others that go around and have sex with everybody. And then there's others who are extremely disciplined and live in total solitude and won't even kill an ant.
Rich of Buddha to be that fat and teach about discipline. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? That's you know.
No. I don't think he would be a Buddha if he hadn't mastered discipline. Because it's just there's discipline and then there's crazy wisdom. First, you have to have discipline before you can go near crazy wisdom, I would say. I mean, otherwise, yeah, you're just a liar. You're not a Buddha. You're a fake.
No, right? But, you know, going back to the point, it's just, yeah, I think there's a difference between having a well-rounded personality, which could be expressed by, let's say, authenticity and the ability to engage in different areas of life successfully,
sure.
You know, being courageous and exploratory and, you know, all these things. This is one thing. Being free of internal contradictions in terms of your worldview, I think that's another layer because you confront, you know, the deepest algorithms or, you know, programs that, you know, the building blocks about your world and your worldview and your personality. And that kind of all has to coalesce and to be harmonious together. And so I think in a way, that's a very difficult task to have a contradiction-free worldview, you know?
Yeah. Sure. Maybe impossible.
It's an idea. Yeah. Impossible. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, even if you are, you know, become this fully enlightened person, yeah, you might still have sort of a body. You know, and you know, you still have to, you know, take a shit and do things like ordinary things, right? And
yeah.
you have your body karmas, right?
Yeah, but Andrew, the question is how much do you have to embody what you preach? That's the question. So let's say like Schopenhauer or Nietzsche, how much do they actually have to be like those embody this authentic
idea?
They didn't.
That's why they're tragic. That's how I feel about them anyway.
Yeah, no, of course.
I know a lot of people will disagree with me, but
of course, no, I completely agree. But nowadays,
but I think they didn't. I didn't. I think they didn't. I think they were tragic, right?
Of course.
You know, Alexander says that, you know, Nietzsche is unfinished, right? Because he went mad.
Yeah.
So I think maybe his journey is unfinished. He leaves all this, you know, all this manure that you can work with.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm talking about now. Like, if we set like a new standard, would like set a new bar, wouldn't it be important for a philosopher today to be embodied, you know, who kind of embodies what he's preaching?
I don't know. Maybe the person is not as important as the philosophy. I mean, what I'm reacting against is this kind of personalization of everything. We want to know everything about this person's sex life, or, you know, we want to know all about. We expect him to hold. We hold somebody up to a standard that they have to be a role model for somebody. And all that, which is, you know, which is important, you know, on some level, but it's not that the whole story.
Yeah, but my argument would be, why engage with the philosophy if not even the author can embody that?
Well, I don't think there is a on one level, there is no difference between the, as Nietzsche said, philosophy is biography in the sense that this was where he was at and what he was understanding in that moment.
Right.
Which was, you know, pretty remarkable, but imperfect. In fact, his philosophy is all about imperfection. And the fact that and no philosophy could be perfect, probably. I don't know, maybe math can be perfect on some level, but I don't think language, I don't think ethics, I don't think philosophy or art or any of that could be perfect. Or it ever, doesn't ever it there's of... always a lack. There's always a, you know, this is the word that Ebert and Cadell and these guys are throwing around. There's always something wrong. There's always something missing. There's always a crack in everything. Why would you hold somebody up to any kind of standard of perfection?
Now, if somebody has, you know, the audacity to pronounce a philosophical system, which he basically wants to attribute to the whole society, at least he should be held to that very standard.
But is that what a philosopher does? That's not what phenomenology doesn't offer a perfect system. That's the whole point. It can't be a perfect system. One cannot offer a perfect system to anything, to anybody. I mean, that would be a mechanical, totally autistic world. I mean, we could criticize all of the philosophers, couldn't we? Go back and say, oh yeah, Socrates, he was like a lazy bum, and then Plato was a fanatic, you know, and Kant never even left his house, and Descartes was completely schizophrenic, and
that's not true. What you say about Kant?
What? I thought he never left his town or something like that, wasn't it? That he lived entirely in this
No. That's an oversimplification, because he had a theological philosophy, which was very rule oriented and not goal oriented. And yeah. So he had a very strict schedule and was always doing the same thing, so that people would, when they would ask.
But he never traveled. He never went anywhere. He never saw the world.
No, because he had his rules he had a rule oriented philosophy. And so there's an overlay between his life and.
You're saying he was consistent with his life and his philosophy.
Exactly.
And in a way, Nietzsche was consistent too, because he said, you know, he said, here I am, pronouncing a dangerous philosophy. This is gunpowder. And of course, no wonder he would go insane, because, you know, if you're walking on the tightrope, you're going to fall, right? You have a good chance of that, you know? So I think Nietzsche's philosophy is very consistent with his person and his fate, despite his internal contradictions. Yes and no, but I think that there's a lack in all of them.
Sure. No, I mean, I'm
Schopenhauer was horrible, and, you know, but I love Schopenhauer, but he was absolutely horrible.
You know, I completely agree with you. The question that I'm still asking is, you know, that I'm not talking about the past. We're living now in a time between worlds. You know, we're trying to find new ways of navigating ourselves within the world, our subsystems and social systems and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we need a new approach to, you know, all of these things, you know, well, like a kind of
consistency. Is that the Wilberian developmental model? The Wilberian kind of developmental model of stages and all that? Is that what you're
No. I mean, like the time between worlds just signifies, you know, all the old systems that we relied on, they kind of don't work anymore. The new ones are not here yet.
Yeah.
And so we're like trying to navigate the space. I mean, I think you could overlay that with Wilber or any other developmental theory, but, you know, the idea, you know, there are some, in my opinion, there are some new people that kind of, they're kind of whole, you know? So if you look at, you know, Thaddeus Russell, to, you know, mm-hmm. point to him again. So he has like this renegade.
No, he's a pothead.
He has like this kind of renegade philosophy and approach to history, but it's also him, you know? He's like a kind of renegade. So there's an overlay. And even like Alexander Barth, there's an overlay of, you know, his kind of phallic.
Oh, absolutely.
Ideal, this network thinking and the way he conducts his behavior. And so it's super, for me, it's like, super important that there's an overlay, authentic overlay between theory and personal behavior. Because like if you look in the past, you don't have that. Fichte and Hegel and Schopenhauer, they didn't need to have this overlay.
Why not? Why not?
Because, you know, because we all kind of developed, you know, we have a new standard for ourselves, you know.
But they had a standard, didn't they?
Yeah, but you can't just, you know, throw the maid down the staircase, you know, if she doesn't, you know, like Schopenhauer did, you know.
I see.
And so, you know.
I see. So there's like bad behaviors that we don't accept anymore because everything is in the media and everything is, you know, everything is transparent and we're not going to accept, you know, a philosopher who would do that kind of thing.
No, we wouldn't even accept a philosopher who suffers from dementia and syphilis, even if his thing would be great. You know, we have different standards now. Yeah. I mean, this is like the thesis, and I think we talked about this in an earlier episode about the performance aspect of all of this. I'm still kind of lingering on that kind of topic, you know, because I think there are new standards, and I'm not trusting a philosopher who can't handle a beer, who can't handle his dick, you know, who can't handle the intricacies of our modern life. You know,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's an interesting argument. Yeah. But I wonder if there are some sort of unusual beings that operate through different kinds of laws, like tropical fish need a certain temperature of water and that we actually if we impose this conventional morality on everybody, that will be crushing a lot of souls, right? I'm not saying that you know, but again, there would be also the problem of, you know, romanticizing the damaged artist. And maybe the artist shouldn't be damaged, you know, maybe the artist should be respected. But then I look at somebody like Charles Bukowski, right? Who he chose to sort of go in the opposite direction. He chose to live in the underworld.
Yeah.
He chose not to play those games. And he did it with a certain finesse and a certain style and that kind of thing. But
yeah. I mean, Henry Miller the same. You know?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
But there's a form of authenticity there.
Authenticity, yes, sure, yes. But I mean, yeah, so there is no different. Maybe you're saying there's. I think your philosophy has to be lived. I mean, otherwise, it's just an abstract system up here that doesn't touch on anything down here.
Yeah, you know, because like Zarathustra is always going down the mountain. He's going Heidegger up. Would say, is a being in the world. You know, it's that you can't separate. You know, your grandiose mind constructs from the way, or you shouldn't.
Yes,
you know,
I agree. Yeah.
To separate that from the world you're kind of inhabiting.
Yeah.
You know, there's a fantastic, have you seen that? There's a fantastic documentary about Heidegger's Being in the World. It's called Being in the World, actually. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
I can send you, it's an amazing documentary. Why it's structured in a way that there are kind of couple of philosophy professors talking about that this idea of Heidegger, and this is intercut with examples of kind of exceptional people, not exceptional in the sense of Johnny Depp, but more like people who are, you know, completely, you know, within the world, you know. And so for example, you know, Dystopia was in Sevilla, Manuel Molina, the flamenco player. Then there's like a Japanese carpenter of pagoda buildings, you know, sure. and like a cook from Sevilla, that like an old lady who did like the most amazing dishes, and they were kind of interviewed and, you know, analyzed about their way of being in the world, and and you know how that is like kind of the ultimate goal, you know, to be the wood that you're carving, to be the dish that you're doing, to be the music that you're playing, you know. Yeah, so for example, you know, with a cook, with a woman, and so she was asked by her daughter, so why don't you do like a book with your recipes? And she answered, because even if I write down all the rules of how I make these and these dishes, you couldn't reproduce it because it's more than just the ingredients, because it's my way of being in the world doing these kind of things.
You can't reproduce David Bowie. You can't reproduce anything
exactly
that is authentic. It can't be reproduced. It can't be it can't even be understood, I would say.
Right, exactly.
It's that complex, yeah, and beautiful, and you know, integrated.
And I think even philosophy should be held to that standard.
Yeah, well, why even philosophy? I mean, why even? I mean,
no, but because philosophy tends to attract people who are like firmly in the abstract realm of reasoning, yeah, without being embodied. That's what we're talking
Which is
about.
Why Nietzsche came along to say, you know, he wanted to be a philosopher of the body and go down the mountain,
right?
He wanted to go, he's always talking about coming down into the body, into the world, into the mountain.
Yeah.
Again, whether he succeeded in coming down himself is very interesting.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
Because in a way he was torn between being up there in the mountain with his animals. You know, Zarathustra wanted to be with the animals, maybe more than he wanted to be with people.
Yeah.
And maybe that's where the psychosis comes in. You know, but that was, you know, we had some disagreement about that on the ITW.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I've always felt about Nietzsche.
Yeah.
But the direction is good. Like, it's almost like Nietzsche is like, okay, here's where we should go. He doesn't make it there himself. A bit like Moses doesn't make it to the promised land, or, you know.
Yeah.
He's pointing in the right direction. So he might not have been able to you know, become Zarathustra himself. That's why he had to make a model of Zarathustra, because he's not Zarathustra. Otherwise, he would just talk about Nietzsche.
Yeah. You know what is weird? You know, coming, you know, from left field in a kind of way. I told you I was just in Sevilla. Mm. And for a couple of days. And the interesting thing is, you know, Spain has such a rich culture, you know, and you can feel 1,000 years of, you know, tradition and history finding somewhat its way into the future, right? Yeah. And so, like, I mean, you know Sevilla, there's like this, yeah, Alameda de Hercules, you know, this, it's one of the oldest, it's actually the oldest European garden there, was built like 1527 or something. Right. It looks horrible, but it's still, you know, it's like four pillars with Hercules and Caesar, and it's fuck ugly. But it's still the center of the town, and all the people are there and partying and drinking. But you know, you can feel the depth and the, you know, the yes, more culture, you know.
And you, like, can contrast that to the palace place, which is very impressive, right? But it's completely fake, isn't it? It was just built, you know, that big palace. I don't know what it's called. Did you go there?
Yeah, sure.
I thought, oh wow, this is so, you know, intricate and beautiful. And then actually it's a Disneyland palace. It was built during, for an expo or something. It wasn't,
right,
it's not actually old. And then I would say, oh, right. This is sort of a mirage of a palace. So that's interesting that would be so impressive to tourists, but then there's this little place over here, which where the real spiritual gravitas is.
Right. Okay. So that was the first part of the story. The second part is that, all that sentiment and feeling and depth is kind of missing from German culture right now. I know this because I grew up in Germany. I live now in Spain for like 10, 12 years or whatever. Germany has no depth. And all, you know, the great accomplishments of the German music and philosophy that kind of died out with the First and the Second World War. And so, you know, we're talking about Nietzsche, we're talking about Heidegger and Kant and Fichte and Schopenhauer and all these people, you know, just, and so there's a breaking of time. And now Germany is kind of void. And I think these kinds of philosophies, they could only happen back then. Now, you know, there has to emerge something new in a kind of way, because it's like we can't just reproduce that kind of being in the world of, you know, these kinds of philosophers. And it's so embedded. You know what I'm trying to say? It's just like in order to be authentic, in order to, you know, have a new kind of philosophy, we have to find a new way of, you know, of an authentic being in the world nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, and find.
But in a way, we have to go through that too, right?
Yeah.
We have to go through. Maybe we have to go through the German philosophers. This is what Cadell would say, that you have to go through Hegel and go out the other side. And even Hegel said you're supposed to forget. You're not supposed to hold on to my philosophy. It's supposed to cause you to think, and then you're supposed to let it go. And then now you are, you know, I don't, the absolute knower or whatever, who you can create your own philosophy. But of course, you have to go through that sort of, you know, a copying, repetition of possession. I think it's often like a possession. Like, again, I think of myself in my 20s being possessed by Henry Miller, when you fall in love with a thinker. And, and now I can see that sort of I can see where Henry Miller was, you know, was a bit off in certain points. You know, he's a bit like, if you read Tropic of Cancer, he's kind of channeling Nietzsche in his own way. He hasn't really found his own voice yet. Anyway, but I was intoxicated by this one person, and I had to read everything about him, and then everything, all the people that he liked, and then, you know, even his worst books. So, and then go through that so I can forget about him, and I never have to read Henry Miller again, you know? If I did go back, I might read it for pleasure, but I think that we have to go through these thinkers. We have to go through them and then get out to the other side.
So why then this prevalence on, let's say, Hegel and Girard? Because, you know, what's with Jaspers and Heidegger and Fichte and Schelling?
I mean, why are we talking about Hegel and Girard and not Fichte?
Like our discourse in the intellectual deep web that is like heavily, you know, it's just Hegel and Girard.
Nietzsche and sure. I don't know. I don't know because I'm not really a philosopher. I guess you'd have to ask Cadell that why he thinks Hegel is so important at this time, and why Zizek thought Hegel was so important, and why the dialectic is so important. I can sort of answer that in my own intuitive, non-philosophical way, is that the dialectic is sort of like Buddhist shunyata. It's like emptiness. It's like the negation of the negation. We have to kind of negate these ghosts and reified patterns that we have to move. Again, it goes along with what we've been talking about, to move to the next thing.
Yeah, but why not? I mean, like, why have this prevalence of for Hegel and Girard? Because you could make the same argument for Schopenhauer.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know why people are not talking about Schopenhauer. I think somebody should come and talk about Schopenhauer for sure. Somebody who should find a Schopenhauerian. I also think, I don't know, when I was in the 90s, everybody was talking about William Blake, and I think William Blake was way more important than Nietzsche, even though Nietzsche was very important for me. But I consider William Blake to be on a higher level than Nietzsche, which will, again, upset the people who love Nietzsche so much. But nobody talks about him anymore.
Right.
So yes, there's obviously people who are missing from the conversation for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where this all leads. But again, I think because if you dig deep enough, you know, you always find the contradictions in somebody's worldview. I think that that's also like one of these, you know, arguments of Schopenhauer. You know, it's like one of his arguments was that you can't just because of the linguistic structure, you can't deconstruct basically every argument, you know, and there are always gaps and what is it called? Like, I'm missing.
Yeah, there's always something missing in the argument. There's always some dimension that isn't being seen because we can't see every dimension.
You know, exactly.
Like, we're not able to see everything. So we have our own cognitive biases. We have our own passions. We have our own perspective, but it's only one perspective, right?
Yeah.
And so the other perspective might be so entirely alien to me. Like, you were talking about this civilian cook. I mean, what she does would be entirely alien to me. I couldn't even begin to understand.
Yeah, Manuel Molina.
How to cook something like that, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, that's otherness. Yeah, so I don't think we should hold people up to a totalizing perfect standard. But then that leaves the question, there is people do talk about, you know, realization and enlightenment and full enlightenment and that kind of thing.
I think we should, Andrew.
Yeah.
I think we should hold them to a higher standard.
No, I mean, we can't hold somebody to a perfect standard. I mean, we can't. I mean, obviously, since we are judging, we should hold ourselves to a high standard. But if we're judging somebody like Nietzsche, you know, so we can say, okay, you know.
I mean,
it's a little bit cheap to psychoanalyze. I mean, I do it, but it's a little bit cheap to psychoanalyze these people. They should have been better in this way, and they should have done this, and they should have done that. First of all, because they haven't. Second of all, because we're not them, and we didn't go on that journey. And what have we achieved? And so it's very easy to put yourself in the position of critic, you know.
But let's be a bit profane, you know, and look at the fractal, you know, of our conversation on a different scale. And let's look at Depp and Amber Heard, because what's happening there culturally is that we see, you know, how contradictory they are, and, you know, that the high standard we put upon these kinds of movie stars, like a couple of years before, this is now completely deconstructed. You know, we see what kind of, let's say sick people they are, you know? And so, but why is that interesting? Why is that live streamed? Why is that interesting for all of us? Because implicitly we are holding them to a higher standard, and the spectacle is to see how these expectations are.
Oh no! Implicitly, we're not holding them to a higher standard. Secretly, we would like to scapegoat them, because we would like to scapegoat Amber, because we found a villain who therefore makes us more blind to our own villainy, or our own shadow, or our own darkness, or our own insanity, right? We say there's the insanity. It's over there. It's not here.
Yeah. But the key, you followed that more than I did. But the key issue was that she was lying more than he was, no?
Oh that yeah. I guess it's what you say. I think he came off as being more authentic than she did in the courtroom. He came off as being more lovable and more authentic and more, you know, and you right away, whether no matter what was true or not, right? This is kind of interesting, actually. It's like, who knows what was true? I think I felt a sort of empathy for him and a sort of disgust for her,
right?
Which doesn't mean that maybe he's just a better actor than she is, and I'm not saying that I'm right in my intuition. And then I was reading the New York Times, and they're saying, "Oh, this is terrible, poor Amber," blah blah blah, and I was like, "Oh, that's weird." I mean, how do I get into the woman who wrote that article's head? I mean, she must really, you know, hate men or something, or she must really, yeah, there's first there's misogyny, you know, Okay. And then, you know, and there's the Me Too movement, which does its thing. And then there's, and then there's, whoa, oh yeah, there's also misandry. There's also hatred for men.
So, but apart from shitting in his bed, what did she do?
I don't know. She's just beating him and, you know, and shouting at him all the time and kind of whining at, I don't know. I don't know what she did. I think they were both kind of, I think it was a dysfunctional relationship, and he married his mother, who was a very domineering type. And I don't know. He was like in a house in Australia. This is one part I listened to. And he said that he had to hide in 16 different rooms to get away from her. So she was chasing him, and he was hiding in rooms and locking himself in rooms, 16 different rooms in the one house. And she was calling you and saying, why are you running away from me? And then why is he running away? Again, why would he run away from her all the time? That's a little weird. I mean,
why wouldn't he fuck her just properly?
Well, who knows? But maybe he was on too much opiates. But
I mean, because the eternal law is, if you fuck a woman properly, she will leave you alone.
maybe he could have hired a sexologist or something like that to help him with, an addiction expert, and who knows what he needed. You know, so yeah, I don't mean, again, it is an interesting cultural moment, because it's like, okay, we've swung from the patriarchy, right, all the way over to the matriarchy, and now we're swinging back into the middle again.
Yeah.
Which is, you know.
I mean, I always notice that when I get, you know, manuscripts, and, you know, there's some talk about the patriarchy, and it's always, you know, it's so ingrained into people's minds that women are good and men are bad.
Yeah, that's what I was getting in the Times. It's like, how could this happen to a woman?
Yeah.
I mean, how could a woman be so, you know, it's like all these victims and they're all women, and no, there's never been a man who has been, you know, tortured to death by a woman. No, that never happens.
No, because, you know, there's like, the one of the first things I learned that, you know, that like, yeah, men have aggressions and are violent and expressing their violence through, you know, physical action. But females are aggressive too, but they are not channeling that with, you know, physical violence, but with social violence. And
I think Amber was kind of a lesbian. I think she was also channeling it through physical violence.
Oh, really?
Because she was beating him all the time, like pounding him. And
yeah. Okay. Yeah, but normally the weapon of choice is social aggression with women. You know,
yeah.
And then you have like psychopaths on both ends of the spectrum. You know, they are like, you know, men who beat women up, and then the women that castrate you symbolically.
Yes. Yeah. And there also are women who beat up men, quite a few of them, more than you think. Which,
you know, because that part, at least part of the feminist movement, is social aggression, and this is like completely, you know, blocked out, you know, that, you know, this, that is a major guilt trip that a lot of women are driving on.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, social aggression. I think we have to come back to a more a middle ground and see that we're both kind of, you know, equally terrible in our own unique way.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, Chogyam Trungpa said that women are crazy and men are stupid. And I was like, that's accurate.
Yeah. So, Andrew, do you want to talk a little bit about, MMA and what you're doing right now? Maybe for the listeners to.
Well, we used to be MMA, and it was my project with the Manifesto, men's group. And we have a group called MMA, which was called MMA. Now we've renamed ourselves for the moment Parallax Media Academy. And it's a Wednesday night event. It was part of a men's group. The Wednesday night is going to become in the fall, it's going to become an open for women and men. We're going to keep the men's group aside, and you know, maybe we could encourage a women's group as well. And it's basically what we're basically going to do courses. We're going to do interviews. We're going to look at different thinkers. We went through Marshall McLuhan, Ivan Illich. We talked about Nietzsche last week,
right?
So with basically Cadell. with Cadell last, and then and Alexander is going to be coming in the next 2 weeks. Alexander Bard. Can't remember what our theme is exactly. Something to do with pathos, logos, and mythos.
Yeah.
Just the different constellations of human experience related to sexuality. And we're designing our course. So basically it's the Media Academy. So we're designing our course syllabus for next year. It'll be every Wednesday night. And so there's more to come. We'll be finished in at the middle of June, and then be doing things for next year. So stay tuned.
Yeah. Alexander was just here and we were talking about, how male and female, just to bring the topics together, how men tend to be pathos and logos oriented, mm-hmm. And females tend to be more myth oriented, and so I found that very interesting because, like, just as a model of observation, because in my experience there's nothing more easy for a woman to change her story, and I find mm-hmm. that so interesting, because it's like every time, as a man,
women are higher in like a verbal intelligence than men,
exactly,
or something like that, so they tend to be more better at more, let's say, fluid in terms of speech, and perhaps that is they're able to create a more maybe they're able to create more believable myths, and men so I guess the danger of that is the danger of that is a sort of totalizing system of myth, perhaps, whereas yeah. Men have the opposite sort of neurosis, is fragmentation, kind of, intellect disconnected from body, fragmentation and abstraction. And so they go into logos, logical obsession.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think pathos, I think we both have our own particular kinds of pathos. There's a male and a female type of pathos that is quite different. I wouldn't say men are pathic. But and perhaps they have a different flavor of pathos than women do often.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, what I find interesting, and my history with women kind of seems to, I mean, maybe I'm biased or whatever, maybe I have a shitty history with women or whatever. But, I feel that women are way more dependent on the way they grasp their world and their being in the world through story. And through narrative and through myth. And so, and sometimes that can change from one day to another, it's like men normally don't do that. Of course, men also depend on narrative and all of this, but I'm talking about,
So you mean when a woman says, I love you and we're going to be together forever and ever and ever, and really believes that when she says it. And then the next day it's like, you're the biggest asshole, and I'm going to, I'm going to burn your home down.
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, I mean, yeah.
Maybe we've all experienced that.
I mean, like for us men, like a good example is like for us men, it's like you choose your friends, in regard of what you can do with him, right? And so mm-hmm. if you can go on a like symbolic hunting party or whatever, you have similar interests, or, mm-hmm. you can put both your dick on the table and see.
It's a project. You get together with men.
You have a good dick.
Be involved in projects.
We're doing a project here. I respect your dick. So let's go hunt some lions or whatever.
Yeah.
But and so if this bond is, forged, it's like very hard to get get rid of that bond. You know, you can always come back to that if two men have found each other and the kind of thing. But a woman, you know, she can get rid of a friend, a female friend, or can get a new friend depending on the story she tells herself. Because mm-hmm. sometimes women fit into that kind of story, and then something happened, then she doesn't fit, and that person doesn't fit into her story anymore. And then, we're not friends anymore. That a man never would say that, or you know, like would kind of never. You know, there's the saying, "Woman can't have friends," you know, because of that very, very aspect of it. Because it depends on their storytelling. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's sort of counterintuitive because it would seem that women have more friends than men. But sure, I think it's easier. Yes, I think it might be a question of women having to keep the community together on some right. kind of a level. So if someone doesn't fit into the community, then it won't work, right?
Exactly, into the story of the community.
The community and the story of the community. So
right.
So women are sort of in charge of the community.
Right.
You know, and I think that's true, you know, even with gossip, right?
Right.
You know, we're talking about men's groups and how when men get together, they don't really gossip about women. They don't complain, you know. They're more men's groups tend to be very constructive and
right.
you know, positive, and you know, stuff comes up, but then they help each other in a brotherly kind of way. But women get together and gossip, and you know, at the well, at the washing, when they're washing clothes, you know, traditionally in the past, this is right. you know, sounds very sexist, they have the power to keep people in the community or out of the community. They say this person is bad or this person is good.
Right.
Right. Because if you're going to be attacked by a powerful woman, you're not allowed in the community anymore. You could be ejected out of the community, which is why men fear women so much. Because women do have power. I mean, well, I think one of the dangerous things in the feminist movement is to pretend that women are not empowered because they have power. Because exactly. I think that women have tons of power, well, even if it's not social or even if it's not political or economic power. They have all kinds of power, but often it's power of deciding, you know, whether you can, first of all, whether you can mate with them, whether you can be with them, you know, and also whether you're good enough. You've got your good enough quality goods to be allowed in the community. So,
yeah, that's what we talked about. You know, the different kinds of, you know, aggression that women tend to be more socially aggressive, men tend to be more physically aggressive, and mm-hmm. you know what Camille Paglia said, that you know women tend to organize around the inner cycle of this, you know, society, and men tend to be, you know, on the outskirts of
course.
And you know, organizing hunting parties and stuff like
that. You know, in Freud's time, the pathology of women was hysteria.
Yeah.
And men is neurosis, because so women, but I think men are hysterical today too. I don't think that's
girly men.
I've met a lot of hysterical men, but like Klaus Kinski, for example, he's a perfect example of a hysterical man. And you know, even Camille Paglia was kind of, you can take the energy of hysteria, and it can be a very kind of powerful, if it's transformed, it can be a very kind of expressive thing. But
Klaus Kinski was a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, he was a sort of a hysterical man. But I think that hysteria, hysteria is tends to be associated with women. And then neurosis with men, because men tend to kind of become fragmented and intellectual and dissociative, and they end up, you know, in front of their computers all the time. And
you know, the story with the ceramic tiles and Klaus Kinski?
No, I don't. What's that?
So apparently, like he was doing another movie with Werner Herzog, and so he was having a fit, and Herzog was like, this is like the short way of telling the story, but Werner Herzog was like locking him in the bathroom, you know, with all the tiles and so he was screaming and shouting and destroying everything, and apparently, you know, when he calmed down and Werner Herzog opened the door, all the ceramic applications and tiles, they were like destroyed to a mush, to like tiny bits and pieces. You know, yeah. He had to, you know, he was like
he was a machine, yeah, for sure. God. Yeah, I like the story of Herzog and Kinski when they were in the Amazon.
Yeah, sure. Mm.
And he was having these hysterical fits all the time, and the native Indians, they say, well, you know, we're going to kill him.
If you want.
We have to. They came to Herzog and said, if you want, we can kill this guy for you. Yeah. And he said, no, that won't be necessary. Yeah. And then actually, it turned out that the native Indians were more afraid of Herzog than they were of Kinski, because
is that true?
Herzog was quiet. He was the quiet, dangerous type, whereas Kinski was just all.
Yeah,
he was all on the outside.
Well, he kind of embraces. He always plays now the villains, no? When Herzog in the movies.
Yeah, now he's sort of the German, the archetypal German villain.
Yeah. Mm. I think we got it, Andrew.
Okay, great.